If your main reason for becoming a lawyer is pay, it's not the right job for you. Hello and welcome to episode 442 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Ben Olson and with me is Nathan Fox. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. Be LSAT famous, share news, and ask questions on our website, thinkinglsat.com. You can also email a voice recording of your question to help@thinkinglsat.com. Just keep it under 30 seconds and record from a quiet place. This is going to come out on Monday, February 19th, and today I'm going to be teaching a class at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. That class is going to be on games, and if we have time, we'll do some logical reasoning, but it's free for everyone. All you need is a Demon-free account. You can sign up for that at lsatdemon.com/free. Also, next week on Wednesday, that's February 29th, leap year day, that's the April 2024 registration deadline. If you're ready for that test, then sign up. If not, then don't worry about it. You're not ready.
Yep.
Let's jump in. We have this first email here from Tony.
Tony says, "Hi, Ben and Nathan. Your content has awakened a dream I had forgotten. In high school, I said I was going to be a lawyer. However, in undergrad, I double majored in journalism and political science, and I'm about to complete my MA in journalism. I don't know why I'm putting the pieces together at 31, but my enjoyable class in my undergrad and graduate journalism programs was media law. And my favorite course in my poli-sci program was con law. Studying journalism, working for a decade in marketing, I've had an interest in media law and the protection of intellectual property, especially now with the rise of AI and the legal questions it presents. Questions. One. Do admissions teams care about my master's thesis? I want to include research on AI and media law. Two, if I began studying in January, should I attempt the June date with Logic Games or should I wait until August? LR and RC are my strongest sections, but I'm still cracking the LG code. Best, Tony."
Let's start with the second question. If I began studying in January, should I attempt the June test date with Logic Games or wait until August? Whether you started in January or not doesn't really matter. What matters is where you're scoring.
Yep.
And so it's hard to answer that question without more information. Do you have any advice?
Yeah. I mean, I don't care when you started. If games are really starting to click, sometimes people can make games click in just a few weeks. You know, I mean, that's how it was for me. I think I probably studied games for like 6 weeks, maybe 4 to 6 weeks, something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just did them every day. I mean, I did a section or two sections maybe every day for like a month. And then it really started to click for me. And then it clicked so hard that I knew I scored perfect on my official section of games in 20 minutes. I mean, it's like when you get it, when you unlock the games, you really unlock the games. How soon is that going to happen for any individual student, including Tony? I have no idea. But, you know, I was thinking, geez, you've still got a some time before whether you need to sign up for April or not. You've got a lot of time before deciding whether you want to sign up for June. So definitely don't decide now. Watch your practice test scores. Watch the LSAT sign-up dates. They tend to be 6 weeks before the official test. Sometimes more. I mean, we've got the February 29 date for the April 2024 test. Actually, that still could be 6 weeks. I don't know how long that one is, but it's a long time. And the deadline for, let's see, we can probably look this up for him, huh? The June deadline, Tony, is going to be April 23rd. So yeah, you've got like a solid couple months, Tony, to prep. And when April 23rd rolls around, you look at your practice test scores, and if they're where you want them, then you sign up for the June test. If not, then the ship has sailed on games for you and you take the test in August or beyond.
Yep.
Good problem to have. I mean, if you're great at LR and RC, then, you know, you're going to love the test in August. But between now and then, if you could solve the games, you might end up with games going from your weakest section to your strongest section in a very short time.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen for everybody, but it will happen eventually.
And the same principle applies, and that is, regardless of whether you can take it in June or not, the ultimate goal here is to take the test multiple times until you get the best possible score you can get. And that, so does that include June or not? I don't know, but it doesn't matter. You can still follow that advice and get a killer score.
Pretty big, pretty common mistake that people make to just determine a test date while they're still prepping.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you're not ready. And you get to pick the test date.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not like the Super Bowl is on February 11th and I have to do the thing on that day.
Yep.
It's rather they offer it 8 times a year and you can just prep at your leisure. And then when your practice test scores indicate that you're ready, then you sign up and then you start taking the test officially until you get a score that represents, you know, the top half of your practice test scores.
Yeah. The first question was, do admissions teams care about my master's thesis? I want to include research on AI and media law. I don't think this is a bad thing. I think you could possibly talk about it in your personal statement, but it's a soft factor and it's not going to do much more beyond that.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't do shit compared to your LSAT and your GPA. So those are the things that you should really be focusing on.
Yeah.
Obviously, your undergrad was settled a long time ago, so you can't do anything about that probably. But you can do stuff a lot about your LSAT, and I'm glad you're working on the LSAT. And that's what's really going to matter. I don't think you should be looking at your personal statement right now, Tony. I don't think you should be thinking about application issues at all. I think that you should be working on your LSAT until you've got the LSAT where you want it. We have to stay focused on the wrecking ball that's just going to bash you right into law schools. Then once you have that wrecking ball, then you can worry about the other accoutrements of your application. And the personal statement is just, you know, it's like, yeah, tell your story. And if you want your elevator pitch to be something about journalism, working in media, did a master's thesis on AI and media law, super excited to get into law school right now because this is a perfect time. You know, that all might make sense as a personal statement.
Can you define accoutrements? Did I say that correctly?
Accoutrement would be like something that goes along with, right? Like, you know, not the steak.
The seasoning or the broccoli on the side?
Yeah, it's the side. Okay, so in the context of food, an accoutrement sometimes, spelled as accompaniment. I guess accoutrement is just probably French for accompaniment. It refers to a secondary item or ingredient that is served alongside a main dish to complement or enhance its flavor, presentation, or overall dining experience. Accoutrements are often used to add variety, texture, or contrast to a meal.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, yours is your analogy was much more sophisticated than mine, but it was kind of related. I was thinking of the frosting on a cake. You got to have a cake before you can put on frosting. LSAT is your fucking cake.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure frosting is an accoutrement on a on a cake. I mean, you could eat the cake. There's plenty of plain cakes.
Yeah.
You know, you put the little frosting on there to give it a little veneer of something, but the cake is what's really important.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, in LSAT, in law school admissions world, I don't even think that the personal statement is the frosting, though.
Mm.
Like the frosting,
like frosting
is kinda,
does more than the personal statement does. Yeah.
Frosting is kind of more important. Your personal statement, like, look, they're going to see your LSAT and your GPA, and they're going to basically sort you into two piles. I mean, there's like the pile of people whose numbers we like, and there's the pile of people whose numbers we don't like. And when they start looking at the applications of the people whose numbers they like, then they look at the personal statement and they're, oh, wow, media law, that's great. But if they're looking at the applications of the people whose numbers they don't like, then this whole thing about my thesis, my master's thesis, whatever, it's like, well, okay. But is that going to move you from one pile to the other pile? I don't know. I would say it's a little bit fraught anytime you start talking about your undergrad. Well, this is not undergrad. It's a master's program. But, you know, speaking as a man who actually has a master's degree in journalism, believe it or not, that master's degree in journalism is worthless. Like, it's not really impressing anybody. And that I would fear that if Tony strikes slightly the wrong tone, he comes off sounding like he thinks he knows everything about media law, AI and media law.
Sure.
And that's definitely not what they want.
No, but I did think, so actually I think the value here is not the thesis, but maybe just illustrating that you have some familiarity with what you're getting involved with and that you're interested in it.
Yeah.
But like you said, you can definitely easily slip into that, well, I'm also an expert.
And it's
right. you're still a student, and you are a student familiar with some of these issues, and you're excited to learn a lot more.
Yeah.
Hey, I wanted to say one more thing to Tony, and that is, it sounds like, I mean, you enjoyed this media law class, you enjoyed this con law class, you wrote a thesis about media law.
Yeah.
There is a difference, though, between your interest in law and the practice of law.
Oh, yeah.
And so I want you to do informational interviews, talk to people on LinkedIn that look like they're doing the job you might want to do. And see how they got there, whether a JD was required. If it was required, great. Why? Stuff like that.
Yeah, because it's kind of like I'm a student of football history. I've got the NFL Sunday ticket. I watch every game every week. I've been doing this for 15 years.
Yeah.
I wrote my master's thesis in my sports. Yeah, right. And therefore, I would like to play in the NFL. It's like, I don't know if those are not quite the same thing. And yeah, like if you're going to go be a lawyer, you're going to get punched in the face, right? I mean, intellectually punched in the face. Yeah. And are you really going to like that? Because you might have enjoyed these theoretical, and I can just imagine how completely not rigorous these undergrad and master's classes were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't like law classes. I'm sorry. They weren't. And I don't care even if a law professor taught it. It still was not like a law class. It was not it was just not like law school.
And even if you like law classes, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to like practicing law.
Nor is law school like legal practice. So, right. So you saying you liked these three classes that you took, not the greatest sales pitch for why you want to be a lawyer.
It may be perfect for you. You just got to do a little more digging.
And ideally, informational interviews, that's great. Get some kind of a job working closer. Like, you're working in marketing now. You know, that's just not lawyer. That's not law. I get it that there are adjacent issues of intellectual property that are interesting to you, but it's not legal practice. So get closer to legal practice.
Yeah.
You want to read this next one from Anonymous about a grade change?
Yeah. Hi, Ben and Nathan. I got an A- in a class and decided to petition for a grade appeal.
Nice.
After nagging the teacher for a half hour, I convinced him to give me a makeup assignment. After completing the assignment, he ghosted all my emails and ignored my request. It's odd. There were only 3 days left till the grade change deadline, so I went to the department chair and showed her my email chain with the teacher. She called up the professor in front of me, yelled at him, and I had my grade changed an hour later. The moral of the story, get the facts in your favor and badger people until you get what you want. More importantly, does this seem like a good teacher to get a letter of rec from? I feel like the answer is obviously no. He hates my soul, so there will probably be plenty of passion put into the letter.
I mean, it's obviously a joke from Anonymous. No, that is not the professor to write you a letter of recommendation. However, I would write you a letter. I mean, I can't write you a letter of recommendation actually, but That to me sounds like a lawyer. Like that, that's you're doing the shit that you're going to be doing as a lawyer, you know, like get the facts in your favor or in your client's favor, then hassle people until your client gets the outcome that they want. In this case, your client is you.
Yeah.
And you did it. You got it. That's fantastic. That's amazing.
Yeah, this is very lawyerly, right? Anonymous had his or her eye on the deadline, right? It's not lawyerly to miss the deadline.
No.
And then go back and ask for an exception.
Right.
You had your evidence. You know, I don't know how your conversations went. It sounds like maybe you said you convinced him to give me a makeup assignment. After completing the assignment, he ghosted all my emails and ignored my request. So maybe there was something there about that interaction that could have gone a little differently and maybe positively that could have kept him committed to your process. But overall, it seems pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, right. Don't get me wrong. Ideally, you would have caught these flies with honey and, you know, the professor would have loved you and been happy to make the change. And then you would have also been getting a letter of recommendation from this teacher.
Yeah.
Who would have been writing about how, you know, you were so diligent that you asked for an extra makeup assignment and then knocked it out of the park on the makeup assignment. And the professor was thrilled to give you an A. You know, that would be a great story to have as a letter of recommendation. That didn't happen. Okay, fine. And it, you know, it could have been completely the professor's fault. The professor could just be an asshole, as so many professors are. And, you know, then you've got the facts on your side because you've got an email chain. You've got this extra credit request or a makeup assignment that you did and handed in, then got ghosted by the professor. You're totally within your right to go to the department chair. Department chair reams this guy out in front of you and your grade change goes through. Love it. That is awesome.
Yeah. All right. Let's jump into pearls versus turds. This is from the Ask Button.
Okay. This student commented on an RC passage about how leading questions can prejudice witness testimony at trial. Yeah, I know. I remember that reading comprehension passage. All right. So the question says, this raises a really interesting concept about reading comp questions, that the questions themselves can be written in ways that fill in the gaps of your understanding and make you think that you read something that you didn't. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Fill in the gaps incorrectly. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Totally.
The questions can do that. Even worse, though, the answer choices, the wrong answer choices can do that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
For me, this caused a light bulb to go off to be aware of this as a possibility in my own reading of LSAT questions. I don't know if it's something you've discussed before, but I thought it was really interesting and perhaps an awareness that others could find beneficial. They don't mention this in the article, of course, but it may be possible that informing witnesses or us as LSAT students of the possibility of leading questions tainting their memory could cause them to have more discernment around what they accept into their memory. Yeah, I don't know that, like, I think that the idea of leading questions is not something that we would call a pearl here, but there is a pearl at the heart of this, right? Which is, if you don't read the passage well enough in the first place, if you get into the question and especially the wrong answer choices before you actually comprehended the passage, then 100%, those wrong answer choices are going to lead you to misunderstand the passage itself. And if you miss the first, you know, like that can happen on the first question is very often a main point question.
Yeah.
Students who don't know what the main point is, they didn't read the passage well enough in the first place. They didn't make a good enough prediction. They go into this main point question hoping that the answer choices are going to explain it to them. And then, man, if you pick a wrong answer on the main point question, now you don't understand, like now you have a mistaken understanding of the main point of the passage.
And that's really bad for the other questions. You know, I think I want to say the same thing that you're saying essentially right now, which is the LSAT doesn't really engage in leading questions, but they do engage in leading answers.
Yeah. Yep. And so it, and it's really similar. In any case, it is very similar to the concept of lawyers can ask leading questions to elicit false testimony from witnesses.
Yeah.
Or correct testimony that they want, the, you know, get them to say the thing that they want them to say, whether that's the true thing that happened or a true memory of theirs or just something that is being implanted right now as I ask you the question. You know, or it's like a cop showing you a picture of the guy that they think did it before bringing the suspects in for a lineup or whatever.
You know, totally.
That would obviously be wrong because now they're going to falsely implant this memory of that face in your head. Well, yeah, that's going to happen over and over and over on the LSAT. And in reading comp is especially the place where you have to worry about it because you're answering multiple questions that are based on the same passage. Again, if you didn't understand the passage, if you struggle on the first question or two, now you've got 10 answers, you know, to those two questions, which include two right answers and eight wrong answers, swimming around in your head, infecting your understanding of the actual passage. And it can lead to a cascade failure where you miss, you know, five out of the six questions on the passage or something.
Totally. And to your point, I don't know the science of leading questions, but I suspect strongly that how well the person remembers the incident dramatically affects how much they're affected by leading questions.
Right.
Right. Like if you're like, no, I know exactly what the fuck happened. I was at this stop sign and this red car went through the stop sign. But if if you're on a bike and you quickly look over to the side and that's when you see the accident and you kind of think it was a red car, you kind of think it was a red stop sign, but you're not totally sure. It's in that cloudy zone where leading questions probably play the biggest influencer, right? Negatively or positively. And that's exactly what you're saying about the passages. Do you read and understand it? Are you predicting answers? And so you're in control, you're laying the groundwork for what the answer should be? Or are you sitting back and being like, well, I'm not totally sure. Let me see what sticks out at me. And then you're getting tossed around.
And then you're either going to miss all the questions or, you know, you're going to struggle with and miss a ton of the questions. And or it's going to take you forever to answer the questions because you really just didn't comprehend. I mean, I had like a little tough love in class last night with a student who was there. And she was insisting that she needs to go faster on reading comp. Mm. And I'm like, well, the only way that you're going to do that and get my seal of approval is by going quicker when you're dismissing wrong answer choices. Mm-hmm. And the only way you do that is by knowing what you're looking for. And the only way you do that is by reading the passage carefully, actually comprehending it, reading the question carefully, actually comprehending that, thinking about it. Oh, well, you're asking me this, and the passage did say something about that. The passage said basically XYZ about that. Mm-hmm. Now start going into the answer choices. And then when A is not saying what you're looking for, next. When B's not saying what you're looking for, next. You don't even have to seriously engage with it on a first read through because you just, well, it's not what I'm looking for. Bye. Oh, there it is. Mm-hmm. Then you read every word of that, comprehend it, understand what it actually says. And if it actually answers the question, then that's your answer. But that's the only way that you get to go fast is by dismissing wrong answer choices quickly. Mm-hmm. If you think you're going to race through the passage or even, oh, I'm going to start reading the passage a little quicker. Well, I don't know. I guess it's just like, look at the scoreboard. Okay. Because people love to say, oh, I'm a good reader. I comprehend it. I just don't get that many points. And I'm sorry, but they're explicitly testing you on your reading comprehension. If you miss questions on reading comprehension, it's because you did not comprehend what you read.
You didn't get it.
That's it. Like, yeah. You either didn't comprehend something about the passage, or you didn't comprehend something about the question, or you didn't comprehend something about the right answer you didn't pick or the wrong answer you did pick, or maybe three of those things at once. But if you're missing points on reading comp, it's because you're not comprehending what you're reading. Sorry. I mean, there's not really a secret to it. You need to read it more carefully in the first place so that you can start predicting these answers, so that you can confidently dismiss wrong answers. And that's how you're able to go fast. But the only way we get there is by letting go of speed entirely and just focusing 100% on comprehending in the first place.
Totally. That's the pearl, right? Don't let the wrong answers lead you astray by making sure you understand exactly what you read in the passage.
I just updated the scoreboard. I gave this one a pearl. I think you'd agree, Ben. There's something here that's worth thinking about.
Yep, absolutely.
The scoreboard is now 28 pearls, 78 turds, and 26 ties. Just be careful where you're getting your LSAT advice, because there's a lot of bad advice out there. But this is a piece of good advice coming from one of our demon students who suggested it using the ask button, and I appreciate them for doing that.
Yeah, if you have a pearl versus turd candidate, let us know at thinkinglsat.com or find us on social at LSATdemon. This next one is from Madison. She writes, "Hi, Ben and Nathan. I am in the habit of taking LR backwards." It's a habit you formed?
Okay. We've heard this before. I mean, this is a turd. We're not doing pearls versus turds anymore, but doing the LR backward is a turd. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a random piece of advice that some people give out there because they're trying to get you to do the harder questions first. But whatever. "I've been doing it for months, and so far it is working well for me. My original thought process was I want to get zero wrong, so I should do the hardest first while I still have the stamina, and then I can relax when I get to around question 10 and know that if I have around 10 minutes left, I'm pretty set to finish in time. I'm averaging around -3 on logical reasoning with this strategy. It has been working for me even while I try to slow down and answer every question right without worrying about completion. Now I'm really trying to hone in on the section and get to -0, and I'm wondering if you would suggest changing up this method. I am open to starting with question 1, and I'm curious about your opinion. Thank you."
Start from question 1.
Yep.
If you're going to run out of time, you want to run out of time on the hard ones, not the easiest ones.
Yeah, imagine the first 3 questions are the questions you're, in theory, never, ever going to get wrong. And if you run out of time and now don't have a chance to do them, well, boy, that's a bummer.
And this whole stamina thing, for one, you shouldn't be running out of stamina at the end of 35 minutes of desk work. If you're running out of stamina at the end of 35 minutes of desk work, you're in for a world of hurt in law school and in legal practice. You know, the entire LSAT, start to finish, is 1/4 of a work day. Ain't no stamina. It's take your time, be patient, get the questions right. If you run out of time at the end of the section, you run out of time at the end of the section, and you guess on a couple of the hardest ones in the section. Furthermore, to the extent that you are going to have any stamina issues, surely the harder questions are more likely to cause stamina issues than the easier questions are. So you're doing like the heaviest lifts first, and then maybe running out of time for the easy lifts.
And stamina, like if you do the first 3 questions, it's highly unlikely that any stamina has been spent, right?
No stamina should be spent on that. No.
Yeah. So you can go into question 4, question 5 with full stamina. So there's no, yeah.
And in fact, I would suggest quite the opposite.
Yeah. That
those first few questions like add stamina to you. Because
you're getting
like,
them right. Yeah.
Yeah. You can hear that like Super Mario, you know, coin sound, just ding, ding, ding. Every time you get one, you do a question, it's super easy. Ding. And it's like, yeah. Boom, there we go. All right. You know, I'm like full power. I'm increasing my power.
Yeah.
Instead of like just bashing your head on very likely the hardest question in the entire section, which, I mean, that's why you're doing it this way, is because you're intentionally trying to do the hardest ones first. But yeah, that last question could be the hardest question on the entire test. And you're going to start with it instead of starting with the easiest one. If you do it, like if you go 24 for 24 at the beginning of the section, then who cares? You never even get to that really hard one and you're already outscoring what you're scoring now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a bad habit. I think it's a bad tip. I definitely want you starting from question one.
Glad you're slowing down. Glad you're not worrying about finishing.
I'm glad you're getting -3 on LR. That's great. But I think we can get that to, you know, maybe we get that to -2 immediately mm-hmm. by just starting from the beginning of the section. Because you're going to be doing, on average, you're going to be doing easier questions.
Yeah. So you're going to naturally get to more almost immediately. Yeah.
Also, Madison, you got to start turning off the clock. You're doing clock management because you just said, I can relax when I get to around question 10 and know that if I have around 10 minutes left, I'm pretty set to finish on time.
Yeah.
Well, you shouldn't know that you have 10 minutes left.
Yep.
The test is going to give you a 5-minute warning and there's no way to avoid that. But you can avoid the clock for the entire section by just as soon as you hit start, you also click the clock, turn off the clock so that you don't have to look at the clock.
If you're really
look at each question.
I was going to say, if you're really not worried about finishing, then you wouldn't be worried about time.
Right. Right. And your problem is not speed. Your problem is accuracy. You're, mm-hmm. you know, you're doing sloppy work when you miss those three questions. So flip it, start doing the test front to back and just expect that you're going to get 100% accuracy on the questions that you attempt.
Cool.
Want to read this one from Anonymous?
Yeah. Hey, Ben and Nathan, I'm applying to law school this cycle and wanted to know your opinions on attending a tier two school where, based on my UGPA, my undergraduate GPA of 3.67, an LSAT score of low 160s, I would be towards the bottom of the class.
What's tier two, Ben?
I have no idea. I'm guessing tier two is ranked 15 and lower, or maybe 21 and lower, depending on what tier one is.
It depends tier on one, who's setting the tiers, right?
Like if tier I'm one could be 21st ranked one through in the three. Country. Yeah.
Then tier one is like the top 25.
Yeah. There you go. You know, now you're tier one.
Right. So I the tier thing is just meaningless. I would stop thinking about the tiers because it is stupid to consider the top 14 as a tier.
Like, yeah, there's vast differences.
Vast differences within the top 14.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but they are just not the same.
Yeah.
Harvard, Stanford, Yale, not the same as Michigan or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So there are no tiers. It's dumb to think about tiers. But anyway, the question really then is, my UGPA is 3.67. My LSAT is in the low 160s. So I would be at the bottom of the class at this particular school.
Yeah. And then Anonymous continues, likely won't get great funding at some of the T2 schools, which brings me to the question, if going to a school like Howard University School of Law, where I would have a higher LSAT and UGPA than their 75th percentile. Wait, that, okay. The sentence just ends there. But anyways,
they
also consistently send their top 30% of graduates to Big Law, which is better than some T2 schools. Should I consider schools like UF and UGA or just go to Howard University if my goal is ultimately to work in Big Law?
I don't think your Big Law chances are very good at any of these schools, to be honest.
Yeah, 30% is not great. I would look at your LSAT score. Bring your LSAT score up. Go to a better school and try to be towards the top of the class. That still may be UF and UGA, but make yourself go to the top of the class, get a full ride if possible, or nearly full ride, and then the risk goes dramatically down. And your chances of being in the top go up. So then your chances of getting to Big Law go up. I would look at your LSAT.
The main scam of law schools is that they give generous scholarships up to and including full ride and even full ride plus.
Mm-hmm.
then to some of the students, other students, they give mediocre aid or no grants at all.
Mm-hmm.
Just loans. They'll still call that financial aid, so be careful. But they'll give loans to the bottom half of the class, you know, scholarships to the top half and loans to the bottom half. Then they pit you against each other in an academic competition, and the winner of the academic competition is the one who gets those big law jobs. So if you go to these stretch schools, yes, they have some big law placement, but you're a worse than average bet to get those jobs. I mean, if a school has 30% big law placement and you're not in the top 30% of scholarships that that school gives out, then you're, to me, worse than an even money bet to finish in the top third of your class and end up getting offered one of those big law jobs. I mean, big law hires largely based on how well you do in your 1L year grade wise. And it ain't easy to get A's in law school. It's a hell of a lot easier if you're smarter and more accomplished than the other people that you're competing against. The way you do that is you take a scholarship to some school because they're giving you that scholarship because you're smarter and more accomplished than the other people who are applying.
Yeah, it just, everything gets better. Your price goes right down, your risk goes down, and your prospects go up.
I mean, whether it actually increases your chances of working in big law is not a certain question. It's just if you
why not? If you're near the top of your class going in based on your LSAT and GPA, aren't your chances of having better grades now higher?
Yeah. Well, but that school has worse big law placement. So it's
sure.
Just,
so what we're talking about, but we are talking about bringing your LSAT up so you can actually even go to a better school. And well, yeah,
that's a different discussion. And yes, I mean, that's really the answer here is if you want to work in big law, get your fucking LSAT up. Like low 160s is not a big law LSAT.
No.
Get a better LSAT. Get yourself into the high 160s or 170 or low 170s. Now you're a big law candidate, in my mind. Because there's plenty of people who go to law school with, you know, even a 170 and still just don't end up with the kinds of legal jobs that they're hoping to get. It's hard. It's not the gravy train that people think it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, anonymous. Get a better LSAT to change the math on all this stuff. Once you have that better LSAT, highly recommend that you look at scholarships first because you just take the risk out of it. I mean, I always say like half the people who go to law school don't end up practicing law.
Mm-hmm.
Way more than half the people who go to law school don't end up practicing big law.
Oh, yeah. If that's your standard. Yeah.
And of the people who do practice big law, like half of them don't practice big law for very long.
Nope. They wash out. Yeah.
So just do not go into debt when you have an uncertain case for big law. Like, you know, the flip of that is that I guess I would sometimes say, oh, you have a 4.0 and a 175 and you're thinking of going to Yale because you want to work in big law. Then it's like, well, okay, Yale is an automatic invitation to big law.
Mm-hmm.
If you're that certain, you know, and if you're that accomplished, if Yale has decided that you're, you know, they give you the blessing of admission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then it's like, okay, well, you know, you're as good of a bet as anybody's ever going to be. And maybe it's worth it.
Yep.
But for this applicant, hell no. Like, I want to go some, I mean, and so I think they're thinking in the right place, actually. They're saying like, well, what if I went to a school like Howard?
Yeah.
And then I'd be in the 75th percentile. And if they gave me a scholarship, then yeah. Is big law going to happen for you from Howard? I don't know. But I don't think you at University of Florida or UGA are any kind of like a guarantee to get into big law either. I suppose we could look. We have the links here to the law school transparency pages UGA. They don't really show a category for big law, do they?
I think they do, actually.
Well, they have jobs by employer type, and they have a like a pie chart.
Oh, they changed it.
Yeah. Well, they
used to say big law. Now it says regional, national. So that's big law.
National is big law.
Yeah.
Regional, that might be like medium firm, because then they have small law firm. You know, but okay, so I'm looking at University of Georgia. 21% go to a national law firm, 25% go to a regional law firm, whatever that means. That does not sound like big law, big salary to me, though. 15.6% go into public service, which is definitely not big money. 14% go into small law firm. 14% go into a judicial clerkship. But if it's not a federal clerkship, then that's also not big law. I don't know. I don't see this as being like a home run of a big law placement school. Do you?
No, I mean, I'm wondering, regional to me sounds like a decent sized firm. Like they have multiple offices. So maybe if
as
you're
opposed
okay,
to a small firm, which is like a solo or one office kind of a thing, at least there's more than one office in a regional law firm, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. So if we add those numbers together, we get 45%, 47%, right? So, okay. But I think Anonymous, who is this? Yeah, Anonymous was saying that they would be at the bottom of the class. So then you're not in the top 47% or 40%. So, I mean, clerkships might be, it's hard to know how this is exactly broken down, but it's definitely not a sure bet. It's 50-50 with lots of money on the line.
I'm reading this story. I'm skimming this story. Producer Eric put on the agenda a story from Reuters from last week that says white students' discrimination case against Howard Law School survives. A white law student who was expelled from Howard University School of Law, a historically black institution, may pursue his discrimination lawsuit against the school, albeit on narrow grounds, a federal judge ruled on Tuesday. Judge Trevor McFadden of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia dismissed the bulk of plaintiff Michael Newman's claims against Howard Law and various administrators, but allowed limited claims of defamation, breach of contract, and race discrimination related to his scholarship to move forward. Wait, scholarship? I don't know if that means what. I don't know if that means grant.
Yeah. Yeah.
That could just mean studying. Yep, the next line. Yep. Newman, who is representing himself, sued the law school in January of 2023, alleging that he was subject to racist abuse and wrongfully expelled from the school in 2022 after clashing repeatedly with classmates and administrators, often over his comments that they deemed inflammatory or offensive. The judge dismissed most of Newman's contract and discrimination claims, as well as his claims of retaliation, conspiracy, and intentional infliction of emotional distress, which he had just learned about as a 1L in torts.
Now he's like, let's try it out.
Representing himself. The university, in its motion to dismiss, said it took disciplinary action against Newman for reasons other than his race, citing his misuse of his school email and listserv, despite warnings to stop.
Sounds like a winner. That's wild.
This guy's going to lose. The lawsuit details a series of messages that Newman, who claims classmates called him racist names, including, quote, the White Panther. He posted to law school listservs, group chats, or emails pertaining to race that his classmates objected to. One message read, quote, where I part with the black community is where they believe government solves problems. I only see it causing problems. And he got kicked out. It is about the scholarship. Oh, the judge determined that Newman could pursue his breach of contract claim that the law faculty manipulated his grades, resulting in the loss of a $26,000 annual scholarship that required him to remain in the top 50% of the class. Newman may also proceed with his claim that the faculty's interference with his scholarship was racially motivated. But the rest of his thing fails. I mean, he's not going to get unexpelled from the school. And his scholarship thing didn't have anything to do with his getting expelled from the school. It's interesting, though, that he is suing them over scholarship shenanigans. But if his, you know, like, the truth is, dude, you finished below 50th percentile in your class at Howard, which is not a fantastic law school. You weren't doing well. You lost your scholarship. And then you cried racial discrimination.
I don't care about this case, but what I do wonder about is this idea of a conditional scholarship based on being in the top 50% of the class. For some reason, that just seems, I guess, I don't know what percentage of their students they're giving those scholarships to, but again, it's just,
they're giving scholarships to people who have better LSAT, better GPA.
But they're also expecting to lose some of those, right? What are we?
At Howard, we can look at the 509. This is a PSA for people who don't know that this exists. If you look at the 509 report, which, by the way, go to lsatdemon.com/scholarships. You can click on the 509 reports for every school. But when we look at this 509 report, in the grants and scholarships table at the top of the third page, we see that, yeah, Howard Law is giving 47% of their class some kind of a grant. 31% of the school is getting less than half tuition. 14% of the school is getting half to full tuition. 2% is getting more than full tuition. So they're not like a really bad offender as far as giving tons and tons of merit scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
They do give some conditional scholarships. Oh, but they reduce and eliminate very few of them.
Yeah, it says of the 87 they gave in 2022-2023, only 5 were reduced or eliminated. It's when those numbers get higher that I get nervous that they're just, it's a fake offer, right?
Well, because we have heard of schools that will, for example, put all the scholarship students in one section and then make them compete against each other for grades.
Wait, I missed that PSA.
You missed
That's it? That's wild. Yeah.
It was a few years ago, and I think that the schools that were doing it got like immediately smacked down for it.
Yeah.
But if you look at this conditional scholarships table that's on the 509, you should be able to see, like, at least in the last few years, have they been doing lots of gotcha, or are they just getting rid of the people who couldn't cut it? And it seems like this school is getting, you know, they're just not giving scholarships to the people who demonstrated in their 1L year that they were not academic superstars. Mm-hmm. In 2020 and 2021, they reduced or eliminated 10 out of 94 scholarships. Mm-hmm. The next year, it was 14 out of 122. The next year, it was 5 out of 87. So, you know, add that all up, you're looking at about a 10% loss of scholarship rate.
Mm-hmm.
And when they, but it is telling, though, because if the stipulation for all the scholarships was that you stay in the top 50th percentile, think about what that means. They're giving scholarships to, again, let's make a couple assumptions, okay, Ben?
Mm.
Let's assume all the scholarships are conditional, because I think that's how it tends to be at these schools, that they're kind of all or nothing. I'm sure some schools have a mix, but I think that a lot of schools, it's like, if they give conditional scholarships, then everyone gets a conditional scholarship.
That's just their deal. Yeah.
That's their deal. And if it'll, and here it's, you have to stay in the top half of the class. And if not, we're going to reduce or eliminate your scholarship. Well, at their school, 47% of the school is getting some kind of a grant.
Presumably the top half. Yeah.
And only about 10% of those are losing their scholarship.
Yeah.
Which means that it's almost 1-to-1 that the people who are getting scholarships are finishing in the top 50% of the class.
Which reinforces the idea that GPA and LSAT are good predictors of your success in law school. And your success in law school is a good predictor of whether or not you're going to get a big law job based on the big law jobs that go to students at that school.
While we're here, I have to call shenanigans on these law school transparency diagram, their charts. Okay. There's no way this can be correct. Look at Howard.
Yeah.
It's an objectively worse school. I mean, 155 is the 50th percentile LSAT.
Yeah.
But on their on their law school transparency page, they're reporting 53% go to a national law firm. Only 4.4 go to a regional law firm. How's that possible, Ben, when Georgia and Florida, higher ranked schools with much higher LSAT GPA profiles, how's it possible that they only have 25% national law firm placement while Howard has a 50-something percent national law firm placement?
It must be location.
That's one explanation. I have another explanation.
Sure.
Just reporting issues. Who decides what's national and what's regional?
It's got to be defined, right?
One would think.
I mean, because law school transparency is reporting these for all schools. Are they just asking the schools and accepting the number as given?
That's my hypothesis here. I'm looking for...
I'm gonna throw out the hypothesis that, yes, it's a school with poor metrics in terms of LSAT and GPA, but somehow being in Washington, D.C. is just leading to opportunities that are national.
That's a hypothesis. Another hypothesis would be Howard University, when they report this to law school transparency, they just consider every law firm a national law firm. Like, oh, if you're in D.C., then you have to be a national law firm. It's the District of Columbia. It's the nation's seat. If you're in the Capitol, you're automatically a national law firm. I call shenanigans. I would love if we could dig into this a little bit further. I don't really know how to.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see. What happens if we click help here?
Wait. So glossary of terms. National law firm is defined as law firms with at least 251 attorneys total across one or more offices.
That's defined.
That is defined.
Do the schools report themselves or I don't know. I just don't like or you're going to a national law firm that doesn't pay the kind of big law salaries that other schools are going to get you. I would have to, you know, I think we should be looking at NALP instead of looking at law school transparency here.
Well, OK. I mean, last idea is that. Just think about job opportunities in Georgia. Most of the law firms around the school are probably small or regional. There's not that many regional or small law firms probably in DC. Well, or relative to the number of national law firms. There's so many national law firms that have offices in DC. They have to. If you're a national law firm, you can't not have an office here. I don't know. Anyways.
We need to do more investigations. I'm predisposed to calling shenanigans because I know how many shenanigans there are out there.
Sure.
I Anonymous is, you know, earnestly trying to compare these big law placements. But I mean, would you be willing to say that Howard has a better big law placement than University of Florida, the by far highest ranked law school in the state of Florida, or University of Georgia, the highest ranked law school in the state of Georgia? I have a real hard time seeing how that's possible when those schools have higher ranking, higher LSAT, dramatically higher LSAT.
Yeah.
Georgia is a 169 median. Howard is a 155 median.
Yeah.
If you're big time law, like that's not big time law. I'm sorry, but that's not big time law. 155 ain't it. So at the very least, those law school transparency numbers are not telling the full story. I would require more information to think about what those actual job opportunities might look like.
Yeah.
Apply more broadly than you're thinking, Anonymous. Don't just apply to these three schools. Apply to lots of schools. And go fishing for scholarships when you do, because the outcomes are very uncertain. even at better schools, the outcomes are really uncertain. Take the scholarship money is going to be my advice.
Thanks for writing in. Yeah, the next one is from Anonymous as well.
Hi, Ben and Nathan. I know in previous episodes you've discouraged students from pursuing JD MBA programs, semicolon. However, I think I could make a lot. I think it could make a lot of sense for my situation. At my university, IU Bloomington, they offer a program where you can get a head start on your MBA during your fourth year of undergrad, and you can obtain an MBA within only 1 year post-grad. It tells you something about what that MBA is actually worth.
Oh, that's all it takes in reality? Yeah.
This is intriguing to me because if I combined this with a JD from the law school, I would still finish 3 years after graduation from undergrad. One main problem is that I have to commit to the program before my senior year, essentially taking myself out of the application cycle unless I choose to attend IU Bloomington, which is where I may choose to attend anyways, but I'm not 100% confident. Currently PTing in the low 170s with a 4.0 GPA, so other schools are great options otherwise. Any advice appreciated. Thanks, Anonymous.
Absolutely 100% do not take this offer.
Yeah. Our advice here is going to be very clear. I'm looking up. I'm trying to find.
Do they even offer like a discount? I mean, I get it that they're throwing in this MBA, but are you going to pay full price for your 3 years of law school? Oh, that would be so. Anyways, such a waste.
Is IU Bloomington even on the scholarship estimator?
Whoa, if it's not. It looks like it is. It just has a different name. Maurer.
What's it? Oh, that's Bloomington. Maurer.
Bloomington is the location, yeah.
Got it. IU Maurer. You know, our tuition roll call tool, what's the link for just straight to the roll call tool?
/tuition, I believe.
LSATdemon.com/tuition. Or you could go to LSATdemon.com/scholarships, and that'll show you all the schools. And then you can click into the tuition roll call for these schools. IU Maurer on their 509 reports that 10% of their school is there on a more than full tuition scholarship.
Mm.
Another 20% are there on a full tuition scholarship. There are 2% of the class that pay full tuition, Ben.
Wow.
11 total students at the school who don't have any grants at all. Poor bastards.
And 19% pay less than they pay more than half. So
right, only 19%. Or sorry, 20 total of 21%.
Yeah.
Who pay more than half. Yeah.
That's
so wild. This is a bad offender. This is a school where 79% of the class is paying something less than half of their nominal tuition.
I mean, it's weird. So why are they a bad offender? They're a bad offender not because of all these discounts they're giving, right? Because the discounts actually help more students at this school go for a price that's probably closer to the reality of what they should be charging. The offense comes in the fact that they're totally milking some students.
Yeah. The bad offense is that they are charging everybody a different price, which
dramatically
I just
different.
Don't think that fits in most people's like sense of justice. You know, I did 2 master's degrees on scholarships, and you know, they like wanted you to keep it hush hush.
Mm.
You know, we're giving you this full ride, but, you know, it's bad form to spread that around the class because we don't want to let people know that some of you are paying zero and some of you are paying a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we're propping up our numbers by giving all of these discounts, but we can't give discounts to everybody. So some people are going to have to pay the full price.
Yeah.
It's just the reason why it's a bad offender is that then leads to worse job outcomes for the people who pay the most.
Yeah. It's really bad.
That's the sinful part.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a man who believes in sin, but that's the part that I would describe as like immoral.
No, you're just saying the technical definition of sin is that you're missing the mark, right? You're not
missing the mark.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not totally sure about that, but you're not on the path. So you're off the path. You're doing something that's extraordinarily counterproductive to our goals, right? If your goal is fairness or a good job,
they're never going to stop talking about justice and fairness and you know, all that bullshit. And it's like, okay, well then that's why I wanted to create this tuition roll call in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm glad it has now sprung into existence for every school magically.
Yeah.
All this is, by the way, is reporting the 509 data. You know, that you can click on this 509 for every school and get right to the report where we get all the information that's on the tuition roll call.
Mm-hmm.
But this roll call is a visualization of that data. And it is clearly not what people would think is fair to say only 21% of our class pays more than half of what we say the tuition is. You know, think about the people who are in the middle of the class getting one of these, you know, let's say they got a 55% scholarship.
Yeah.
They think they got a great deal.
Yeah.
Not really. Not really. Because there are 30% of the people who are paying zero,
mm-hmm.
or who are actually getting paid, apparently. We don't know what more than full really means.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be a stipend from the school. It could be that they just somehow magically got more scholarship grants than even the tuition was.
Yeah.
And they might be getting a check from the school.
And yeah.
So then, you know, those middle people who were enticed to come there by like, hey, look, our tuition's $58,000 and we're going to give you a $29,000 scholarship. And they think, oh, that's fantastic. Wow. You really want me, huh? Well, no, they really want the 30% who are paying nothing at all. That's who they really want. You're there to keep the lights on. And the people who pay more than half or the people who pay full tuition, those are the real suckers in the game. Mm-hmm. So I call this a bad offender because I don't want there to be suckers in the game. I just don't think that for people who never shut up about justice, I don't think that this is fair, especially, Ben, when we take into account the idea that not everybody who graduates from this school is going to find productive legal work. And when we consider the fact that the people who do the best in grades are going to be the people who get the best jobs. And the people who do the best in grades are going to be highly overrepresented in people who got scholarships to begin with, because they're entering the school with better undergraduate grades and a better LSAT. And those two things don't mean everything, but they do mean a lot.
They do mean a lot. I wonder if this is a future project, preferred to the tuition roll call, we could have overlays. So, for example, national law firm placement.
Yeah, right. So yeah, I mean, or compare it side by side or something so that you just get an idea of like, oh, you've got 30% full tuition plus you've also got 30% big law placement.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody thinks they're exceptional, right? So you're always going to have people pushing back going, well, yeah, I understand that I'm an underdog, but I've been able to achieve at every level and, you know, I'm going to make it happen.
I'm going break through. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can break through. You know, it is possible that some people break through, but on average, we are average. And though, you know, if their big law placement is actually 30%, then that means that 70% of the class is not going to get a big law job. And if you're there borrowing their exorbitant, you know, fake tuition, because it is fake for 98% of the class.
Yep.
2% are the people who are actually paying sticker price. If you're there paying that fake sticker price, you're not a good bet. In fact, I would love to bet against you. Like, I'll just take all bets. Some of them I'll lose, but I'll win vastly more of the bets. If I got to bet on all the people going to law school paying full tuition, I'd love to bet that it's not going to work out for you.
You'd love to bet because you will win financially, not because you will enjoy the outcome that they will experience.
Oh, And I would never actually make the bet because I don't want to just, you know, beat up on people who are already getting plenty beat up on.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to have any money to pay off the bet. So I'm not going to take the bet. But it's like so obviously unfair.
Mm-hmm.
That drives what we do here. I mean, that's why I want to keep working on this shit.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it strikes me as so wildly unfair. And we're finally shining some light into it, I think. And I think that this roll call can shine a lot of light.
Yeah.
LSATdemon.com/tuition.
/tuition. Yep.
Take a look at some of these pages. They're all works in progress. All we're trying to do is report the 509 data. If there's stuff that we're missing, if there's stuff that we're doing wrong, if there's things that we don't understand, please tell us. You can email help@thinkinglsat.com. We really want to get better at all this stuff. But for now, you know, we're just at least talking about it and trying to get people to make better decisions.
Yeah.
Where were we? Oh, I don't think we finished our advice really for Anonymous.
Dude, oh, really?
You have a low 170s and a 4.0.
Mm.
You need to apply broadly and let the schools bid on you. It's insane for you to take one of these. Like, you're going to end up paying tuition at a school where very few people pay tuition.
Also, you're still in undergrad. You have a 4.0. It sounds like you have the ability to potentially get a higher GPA depending on how your school does grading. Is 4.0 the max? If it isn't, then you could eke out a few more points. I don't know if it matters. Does it matter?
It might be one of these schools that, like, they put A pluses on the transcript, but they only count them as a 4.0.
Yeah.
If that's the case, you want to get as many A pluses as possible because LSAC's going to consider those A pluses a 4.3 when you apply.
Hmm.
Keep getting straight A's. Don't worry so much about the LSAT because you're already crushing it. As long as you're getting straight A's or straight A pluses, then you can study for the LSAT. Take the test as many times as you need to get yourself your 175 or whatever. Apply early, apply broadly. Do not take advantage of this stupid program that is just there to entrap unwise undergrads.
They don't want to lose you. That's why they're forcing you to commit before your senior year.
Right. Right. It always serves them. They'll make it look like it's good for you, but this does nothing for you. All it does is it forecloses a whole bunch of opportunities to go to better places and better schools for better prices.
Not only for free, but very likely stipends given the offers you'll get. So,
oh, if you go to our scholarship estimator and you put in low 170s with a 4.0 GPA, I mean, I'm going to do it right now. LSATdemon.com/scholarships. Down here at the bottom, I'm going to put a 4.0 on GPA. I'm going to put a 170. I think you're probably above that, but we'll just put a 170.
Yep.
Update. I'm going to scroll down until I start seeing blue. Possible stipend at number 16th in the country, USC.
What'd you put? 170 what?
170 nothing.
Oh, 170. Okay, yeah.
4.0 and a 170. I see a possible stipend at USC.
Yep.
Do you know what USC does not have? Winter. There's no winter. It's Los Angeles. It might rain sometimes, but it's so nice in LA all the time. It's just amazing. It's just incredible. You're coming from Indiana with freezing ass cold winters. You might be able to go to USC, pay zero tuition, get a stipend potentially, walk around in shorts, looking at all the beautiful people and the palm trees.
Look, I don't, but here's the crazy thing. I don't think Anonymous is going to end with a 170. I think a 174 is almost conservative.
No, I was unselling it. I was underselling it at a 170.
Yeah, if you get a 174, you got a possible stipend at UVA, ranked 8th in the country.
Yeah. Michigan, ranked 10th. UCLA, ranked 14th. Texas, ranked 16th. Vanderbilt, ranked 16th. USC again, and then still Georgia, North Carolina, BYU, Wake Forest, Florida, Ohio State, Boston, Notre Dame, like just so many schools with your numbers, you should be expecting a full ride scholarship, if not a stipend.
Yeah.
To go to law school. And this is, yeah, this is a terrible, terrible program for you. That IU Bloomington is offering you.
Mm-hmm.
Just terrible. I'm glad, Ben, that your immediate reaction was like a hell no. Good one.
Yeah, this next one is from Zeke.
Hi, Nathan and Ben. For the past year, I've been working as a first-term apprentice electrician. Oh, that is rad. Does this seem like work experience that law school may find valuable? Oh, fuck. I thought you were going to say you've decided not to go to law school because you think you could do something better.
Yeah.
My wife and I have one daughter. We hope to have four kids and we hope to become a single income family. The main reason why I became an electrician is because it seemed like a reliable path to an income sufficient to support my family. Dude, you could also start your own electrician company and become wealthy.
Electrician anyway. Is a job that is unlikely to be upended by the AI revolution.
Yeah, like literally not possible until, you know, Android style robots are formed that are going to come into your house and do the wiring for you.
Yeah.
Until then, electricians will always have jobs. It's fucking impossible. Have you tried to get anything done around your house, Ben, in the last couple of years?
Yeah.
It's just like so impossible to get anybody to do anything.
No, it's so true.
The rates are exorbitant and you can't even get them to come.
Yeah. You're like, I thought we were meeting on Monday at 9:00 and they're like ghosting you until Wednesday. And they're like, yeah, we can come next week on Thursday. And you're like, what the fuck?
Zeke, if LSAT Demon ever went away and I couldn't be an LSAT teacher anymore, I would be far more likely to become an electrician than I would to become a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to be an electrician. That would be awesome. I would have to learn a whole bunch of shit that I don't know anything about, but I'm pretty confident that I could start a successful electrician company. I feel like I could. I'm smart. Mm-hmm. I'll show up. I'll learn about the shit. I'll do the shit that needs to be done. I'll hire the right people, you know, and like I'm decent enough at running a business. Because all you have to do is answer the fucking phone and do your job.
Actually, show up. That's all you have to do. When you said you will. Business. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And like you, that already is such a great opportunity for you and your family.
Listen to this next
sentence.
But he's
looking at law school instead.
Yeah, listen to this next sentence. This is going to kill it. This is going to end the discussion.
Okay. This is also a main reason why I'm considering becoming a lawyer, though I also want more intellectually stimulating work. Sorry, I almost vomited. And a higher capacity to do good in the world, if only through donating. Oh, okay. I see. So you're going to get a big law job and be evil, but then, make a lot of money so that you can donate the money.
You make the money off of the big law company, which is the big law firm, which is hiring
criminals.
Yeah.
Literal criminals. You're going to be defending, you know,
OxyContin, pollution, just oil, whatever it is. Yeah.
You're going to be making a shit ton of money defending the evil people
to them,
so that you can then make money so that you can donate it so that you can make the world a better place.
Not the right plan.
Not but a good plan.
I didn't even read that whole sentence. I just read the first part. This is also a main reason why I'm considering becoming a lawyer. If your main reason for becoming a lawyer is pay, it's not the right job for
you. No, it's so the wrong job for you.
Yeah.
If you just want to make money, you should start a business. And if you can't start a business, you know, people are like, I'm just so opposed to it. It's too scary for me. I have to work for somebody else. If you have to work for somebody else, God.
No, you don't. You don't have to. So what you do is you do this apprenticeship. You work as an electrician if you need to, and then you start something else on the side. And then eventually when you feel comfortable, you leave.
I would think that if you're a really good electrician, you also could just get raise after raise after raise. Like you should be so in demand
Yeah.
Everybody wants your services. I mean, every house, Ben, that was built prior to 2010 doesn't have enough fucking outlets in it.
Yeah. Like, let me tell you, I could go on for 10 minutes about the problems of my wiring in my house.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. Okay, let me finish this up. All that is to say, says Zeke, money is a big factor in my desire to attend law school. Is this something I should avoid letting show through in my personal statement? Canadian law schools are not included in the LSAT Demon Scholarships calculator. Are you able to comment on how a good LSAT may affect law school affordability in Canada? Thanks, Zeke.
Zeke, your questions are irrelevant. Law school is not for you. You're going for the money. It's not a good path to go for the money unless you love law.
I agree. It is not a good idea to go to law school because you think that it's going to be a lucrative career. Law school is cheaper in Canada, and you might be able to get your province to pay for it. We don't have scholarships on, they're not ranked. They're not. The reason why we were able to build the scholarship estimator is because we have these American Bar Association 509 reports where they have to report the scholarships that they give. Canadian law schools don't file these reports. They also just don't give scholarships the same way. They charge more reasonable prices, and they don't tend to give grants the same way that US schools do. So you're going to be in Canada, it's more like fair, right? Mm-hmm. Canada, you're going to be looking for, okay, this is what they actually charge people. Is it worth it to get that, you know, to get the job that I'm going to get coming from this kind of school?
Yeah.
But again, yeah, I totally agree with Ben. If you think that you're doing this for the money, just do something else, man. Just do anything else. Like, actually do things in the world, which electricians do. And not all lawyers do. I mean, a lot of what lawyers do is they just fight over money. And I don't think that that's the kind of guy that Zeke probably is.
Yeah.
Not to mention, you want to see your kids sometimes, I presume. You don't want to just have four kids and never see them, right?
Yeah.
But like, if you're going to be the kind of lawyer who makes a lot of money, you're going to be working 6-7 days a week, 10, 12 hours a day, always on call, always in the office. You're just not doing the thing that you think you're doing for your family. Sorry to be so dark about that, Zeke. All right, last one. We have a tip here from a departing demon. And I thought this was interesting because of the stats and because of Nathaniel's tip that he gave on his way out the door.
Yep. So he writes in all caps, drill, drill, drill.
Did Nathaniel drill, drill, drill? Did Nathaniel do the work? Well, 151 total hours of studying, 204 games, 14 reading comp passages, 441 logical reasoning questions, 96 hours just spent on drilling. And okay, this is with a basic LSAT Demon subscription for about 6 months and increased his score by 19 points doing that. So it works, y'all. Just hit drill in the demon and start doing real LSAT questions. If you get stuck, you read our explanations, you watch our videos, you use the ask button to talk to our amazing team of tutors that are behind the ask button. And yeah, you can make huge improvement just studying on your own like Nathaniel did.
Awesome.
Good job, Nathaniel.
Yeah.
All right, last thing is words of the week. This is coming from a reading comprehension passage.
Yeah, okay, we got two words. I don't know how to say them exactly. I'm going to try Macropterus. Macropterus?
That's what I would say, yeah, Macropterus.
And then Micropterus.
Macropterus and Micropterus. And I know exactly what this is from in a reading comprehension passage. Macropterus means large winged, and Micropterus means small winged.
Okay. Do you know those words because of the RC passage, or did you know them?
Absolutely. I only know them because of the reading comprehension passage about that topic. You can learn a lot of shit from those reading comprehension passages. They're actually really interesting. I was learning about the veil of ignorance the other day and how that's how you like set fair situations for society.
Interesting. You know,
that's like the one kid slices the pie and then the other kid picks which slice they want.
That's the veil of ignorance. You don't know who's
that's John
get
Rawls
it.
veil of ignorance that I was learning about in a different reading comp passage. But yeah, the Macropterus individuals, as I recall from the reading comprehension passage, they had big wings because they needed to fly places, I guess. And the Micropterus individuals in this population, they actually didn't use them to fly, I don't think. They just kind of stayed in the pond where they were born.
Hmm. And it does say here that the RC passage defines these terms, which is totally unsurprising because these are not terms that anyone would be expected to know.
And, and the lesson there is that it's a big part of reading comprehension is to not expect to know every single word. You don't have to know every single word. Mm-hmm. If it's a scientific thing at all, they're going to just give you the definition.
Yeah.
And that's what they did in this reading comp passage. Should we wrap it up?
Yeah, let's do so. Be LSAT famous. Please ask questions or share news with us at thinkinglsat.com. If you have questions about the LSAT demon, you can always email our help team. They're at help@lsatdemon.com. Check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 442 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.